Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is on the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be doing a health program, and we do them throughout the year. We have shows that are have a fairly wide focus. We have an OBGYN. We have a family practice doctor. We sometimes have people who have various specialties. And we do have a program now we've been doing for a long time on a regular basis to talk about women's health. And we thought, well, at least one time here, every once in a while, we should do something that's really aimed at talking specifically about issues for men's health. And that's what we want to try to do this morning. Our guest for the program is Ronald Peter Conchanan. He's a urologist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And we'll talk about a number of things. And one of the things that we wanted to certainly start out talking about is the prostate and prostate issues. Questions about that or anything else certainly are welcome. I know the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. Whenever we have physicians on the program, though, the one thing I always try to mention at the beginning is we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone. That means there are some limits as to what the doctor can do. But we do these programs to try to add to your health knowledge and give some basic information. And I'm sure that we can do that, and the doctor will do his best to answer questions. So having said that, the number, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. What now is the incidence of prostate cancer in the United States?
Well, prostate cancer and lung cancer keep juggling for what's the most common, but it is either one or two, depending on how it shakes out this year, in terms of solid tumors in adult men. So it's a very, very common cancer.
And certainly if you're not a smoker, then it's going to be the number one thing that you would want to be concerned about.
Yes.
Maybe just let me ask this basic question. What does the prostate do? What is its function? What's it there for?
The prostate just makes secretions that are needed to support the sperm outside the male body. So nutrition for the sperm cells so they can survive on their journey.
Mm. And it's something that over the course of a man's life, even if it's not cancerous, the prostate naturally becomes enlarged, so it potentially can cause some problems even if we're not talking about cancer?
Yes. Under the influence of the male hormone, starting about 45, the prostate begins to grow in size and volume. And if the bladder can, the urethra or the tube that the urine flows through passes right through the middle of the prostate. So the bladder has to compensate for the prostate growing. And if the bladder is able to, then the patient does okay. If the bladder says, oh, I'm getting tired as the prostate begins to squeeze, then the patient can notice he's having a hard time starting his stream, has a slow stream. It starts, it stops, he dribbles.
Mm. Well, just if we talk for a moment about this benign enlargement of the prostate that seems, I guess, to be fairly common,
mm-hmm.
Is there much that you can offer to a guy who's having those kind of symptoms, having those kind of problems?
Yeah, we have a stepped therapy. If symptoms are really minimal and the patient wants to try some saw palmetto, which you can buy in any drugstore, or prostate, you know, men's health formula, whatever, there are so many of them. Many of those people with mild symptoms can notice some improvement with that and maybe be very, very happy. If not, there are a couple of prescription medicines. There's two classes. There's alpha blockers, which relax the squeeze of the urethra. The urethra is wrapped by muscle, and the muscle has a normal tone. Alpha blockers relax the tone of that muscle and therefore allow the urine to pass easier. The other class of medicine is the 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, and that's designed to shrink the volume of the prostate so that the physical bulk, the physical squeeze that the prostate is putting on the urethra is less.
Mm-hmm.
And those are very, very successful. And the number of people that have had to resort to surgery these days compared to 1970s or something like that is much, much, much less, that we're able to treat people medically and keep them fairly happy symptomatic-wise. Mm.
Is there anything else that someone could do, you know, lifestyle-wise that would tend to slow or reduce the prostate enlargement, or is that just something that's kind of going to happen and there's not much that you can do about it?
It's kind of going to happen. If boys are castrated before puberty, they don't develop BPH as adult men. But other than that, which is obviously a very radical treatment, it's a fact of nature.
As far as prostate cancer is concerned, this is something that tends to affect men late in life. And it is something that I suppose if there's a good side to prostate cancer, that is that it's a cancer that grows slowly. That doesn't mean that it can't be serious and doesn't need to be treated. But is there some sort of understanding about exactly what the mechanisms here are and why it develops at all?
First of all, the family history is becoming more and more important in prostate cancer. If one male relative has prostate cancer, that raises your eyebrows. But if you have two male relatives in your family with prostate cancer, that really increases your risk. So there is some genetic thing going on with prostate cancer. There's no specific gene test yet for prostate cancer, but we do see it running in families. There's a lot that's going to be coming out in the next couple of years from the infection people who say that prior history of prostatitis or prostatic inflammatory diseases may predispose to the development of prostate cancer down the road 10, 15 years or something like that. So if people have had a history of prostatitis, that may be it sets up something in the prostate that may make the development of prostate cancer more likely.
Hmm. So other than family history, that's what you talk about risk factors, that's going to be probably your number one thing to look at. And now you're saying if you have had some history of prostate infection, that might be a kind of a thing to again, that would be a check that you would want to have as part of your history here, the thing that you would think about. Is there anything else that one could point to reliably as a risk factor?
Not really.
So that, certainly if you have somebody who has family history, that would be something that would make you concerned. But given that you really don't know, then I guess that brings us to the point of screening.
Yes.
Periodic screening. And what it is now we are recommending for men to do as part of their regular checkups?
Well, the American Urological Association, my parent organization, recommends that men 50 and above, 50 to 70 at least, be screened annually with a PSA and a digital rectal examination. African American males and men with a family history should start screening sometime before that, and that's a little controversial. Does that mean 40, 45? Some have suggested 35 for high risk groups, but somewhere earlier than that, at least 40, we'll say.
Mm-hmm. So basically, I guess the general recommendation is that age 50, depending on what circumstances apply, that you would say, well, certainly at that point, you ought to get your PSA, and this is a blood test.
A blood test.
You get your first one, so you get your baseline. Mm-hmm. And then after that, really, I guess the recommendation is that every year it should be checked.
Yes.
In addition to having a physical examination of the prostate, just to see, does it seem to be enlarged? Is there anything you feel there that maybe makes you concerned? On the PSA, what you're going to do, you'll go and they'll take the blood, and then sometime later you'll get a little thing from your doctor that has a number on it and says, okay, this is what it is. What does that number tell you?
There is some controversy on the best way to use PSA. Some physicians have suggested if you really want to look for prostate cancer, set a cutoff point of 2.5 for everybody. And if your PSA is above 2.5, that's suspicious. Most PSA manufacturers of the lab test set a cutoff point of 4.0 for PSA. Above that, that's considered elevated. And then the third school of thought is to use a progressive upper limit of normal so that as you age, you increase the upper limit of normal. So a PSA above 2.5 in a 40-year-old would be considered abnormal, but a PSA above 3.5 for a 50-year-old would be considered abnormal. And someone in their 70s, the value goes up to 6.5. So you're allowing gentlemen as they age to make a little bit more PSA before you begin to worry.
Yeah. Having an elevated PSA is not necessarily an indication of prostate cancer.
Correct.
It says, well, something's going on, so we need to take a look and find out what. I mean, you could have prostate infection, and it would give you a higher PSA.
True.
So once you have somebody, you do the test, the number comes back, and so you're saying, okay, I'm concerned about this number. I think that it's higher than it should be, or at least it indicates that we need to take a closer look here and see what's going on. Where do you go from there?
Well, the first thing that I do is to repeat the PSA and confirm that it's a true elevation. There was a wonderful meta-analysis that was done just a couple of years ago looking at that question. Suppose we have gentlemen with an elevated PSA. What if we wait 6 or 8 weeks and repeat the PSA? What's the chance of the PSA coming down to normal or to the guy's baseline? Mm-hmm. And a meta-analysis looks at all studies that were done on this subject and sticks them all together so they get a big database. And the range was 40 to 80% in all these studies. So that means in 40 to 80% of people, if you just watch, the PSA will come down. However, only one of those studies was at 40%, and most of them were centered at 70 to 80%. So the majority of the studies show that about three-quarters of guys with an elevated PSA, that if you wait 6 or 8 weeks, it comes down. So I think in my practice, the most prudent thing is if I see a gentleman with an elevated PSA is to repeat it in 6 or 8 weeks and see if it comes back down to normal.
And if it doesn't?
If it doesn't, then and that guy has a persistent elevated PSA, then I would recommend a prostate biopsy because an elevated PSA carries a 1 in 4 risk of a diagnosis of prostate cancer.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ronald Peter Conchanan. He's a urologist at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and we're talking about men's health, and we started out here talking about prostate sort of issues. If you got questions about that or anything else that's really specific to men and male plumbing, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. What causes, or I'm not sure to what extent it's known, but prostate infection, what do we think causes that?
I think that prostate congestion certainly has something to do with it. The prostate is a gland that makes secretions that we said that the sperm cell need for life outside the body. If the prostate builds up and isn't exercised, and the secretions build up and sort of sludge up the prostate, then I think that can predispose to inflammation and or infection. Yeah. So generally, you know, the prostate was made to do its job. It should be exercised regularly to avoid prostatic congestion and
Yeah. Well, I guess that certainly invites the question about the relationship between one's level of sexual activity and prostate health, and whether, in fact, if we took two guys, who, all other things being equal, if one's level of sexual activity was low and the other's sexual activity was high, you know, I don't know how it is we're going to define that, but, you know, a clear difference between the frequency of sexual activity. Does the guy who is having more sex come off better than the guy who is having less?
I can't quote a study that says yes or no on that one. But one would think, again, if the prostate is is meant to make these secretions and get rid of them. If mm-hmm. they're not building up, if they're not sitting in around, and if there's not stasis of this stuff, then that prostate has to be healthier.
Hmm. All right.
But that's sort of a gut impression.
There, so yeah, there's no real, you know, the American Academy of Urology is not staking out a position that says, go out there and do it. Your prostate will be better.
No.
No. All right. We have a caller here in Rantoul on our line number one. Hello.
Go out there and do it. Your prostate will be better.
I would put that on a bumper sticker, and we'll see if we can sell it. Yeah. Go ahead, caller. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I recently had a blood test and an echogram, and they said my prostate was enlarged. I haven't had any complications that I know of. Does that mean you got cancer, or can it be treated?
Well, just having an enlarged prostate doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have problems. That's a frequent consult that we get. The family practice doctor feels a prostate, says, oh, your prostate's big, go to urology. One of the things then we ask is, well, how symptomatic are you? You know, there's symptom score sheets where you can write down what kind of symptoms you're having. We add up a score, and we can put you in minimally symptomatic, mildly symptomatic, or severely symptomatic. And I think the decision to do anything is not based on prostate size, but is based on how does it affect you. If you say, I'm voiding normally, I have a good stream, I sleep through the night, I'm comfortable, I'm not having any urinary difficulties, then the size of the prostate doesn't really mean anything. In terms of blood test and prostate size, the issue can be, I guess it depends on what the PSA is. If you have a guy who's sent to you with a very, very, or a moderately elevated PSA, and he has a large prostate on examination, there is something called PSA density, which is a artificially derived. Well, if the prostate's this big, shouldn't it be allowed to make so much PSA determination? That's not a perfectly scientific test. It's more of a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants test. But certainly a guy with a markedly enlarged prostate will allow him to make a little bit of greater PSA than perhaps his next-door neighbor whose prostate's smaller.
Okay, I get about five times a night and urinate, not a lot, but just enough to wake me up. Is that a prostate problem?
Well, there's two patterns that we see in terms of waking up at night. One is nocturnal polyuria, where the patient gets up but basically is voiding large or normal amounts of urine. That guy, he's just mobilizing the fluids that he's taken in at nighttime, and his bladder is filling up and it's behaving normally. It's the bladder saying, hey, I'm full, it's 2 a.m, I don't care, I'm full, you better go. The other abnormal type is, I'm waking up but I'm only going a small amount. Then you worry about, is that that might be a prostate issue, that his bladder's not emptying and he voids a little bit off the top, leaves some behind, the bladder fills up again, it's saying I'm full again, he voids a little bit, and that may be an issue. That's something to discuss with your physician.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks. But again, if you have a situation like that and you've got a PSA that maybe is slightly elevated, but not so much to get you concerned. And if that's something that the patient says, well, yeah, I do that, but that doesn't particularly bother me, then you would say, well, okay. Then in that case, maybe we'd, if you don't, I've looked at it and I don't really think that this is a problem. At least I don't think that you have prostate cancer mm-hmm. or anything like that. And if you tell me, well, yeah, you get up a few times during the night and you go to the bathroom and you go back and go to sleep and it doesn't really bother you, then I would say, well, okay, then I don't think you have a problem, and apparently you don't think so. So then maybe we say at this point, we don't have a problem.
Yeah, and just keep an eye on and observe. One of the other ways to use PSA is serial determination. Not to sort of focus on what's the value today, but what's the trend? My PSA was 3.5 this year, and next year it's 4.5, or and then after that it goes up to 5.5, and you say, hey, that PSA is really shooting up there over mm-hmm. time. That's also a suspicious thing. So even on the guy who say, okay, where you're not symptomatic enough for me to worry about it, and your PSA is mildly elevated, we'd say, hey, let's still follow with serial PSA, whether that's done through your urologist or your family doctor, it doesn't matter. But let's see what that PSA does over time and whether that's going to change.
And but do you, though, expect, as a sort of a natural course of things, that over time the PSA will go up?
Slightly. Okay. If it changes greater than 0.7 nanograms per year, then that's considered a significant rise in the PSA. So if it goes up, it's 4.1 one year and then it goes up to 4.3, that's not a significant change. But if it goes from 4.1 to 4.9, you can say, wow, that's a little bit more than we would expect that to go up in the course of a year.
Okay. Let's talk with some other folks here. Next, we'll have somebody in Champaign. This is line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
I don't know if you've covered this or not. What, if anything, is going on with saw palmetto? Last I knew, there was some reason to think that there might be some advantage to this stuff, but it was just too hard. No one had isolated the active ingredients, and there was, you know, variability in the berries that the stuff was made from and so on and so forth. So could you just kind of give us an overview of what's going on with that, if anything, or if there's any compounds that are I've had problems with my prostate all my life, and you know I'm prone to getting infections and things. And there are things that over-the-counter things things I could take. As an example, I take selenium. My mm-hmm. urologist recommends I take selenium, and so forth, and just things like that. The basic nutrition and herbal remedy overview, and if there's anything there, and so forth. Thank you.
All right.
Well, in terms of saw palmetto. I think in my practice, saw palmetto works for guys who have mild symptoms. The guy who says, my stream is just a little bit slower than it was 10 years ago. Not I'm pulling my hair out because it's awful, but just a little bit. The guys who are mildly symptomatic, many of them will respond to saw palmetto. Whether you want Pygium is another herbal thing, whether you have that in the mix or not, it seems that saw palmetto is the main ingredient there. For guys that are significantly symptomatic, they don't respond well to saw palmetto. So I think saw palmetto really fits in best with the late 40s, early 50s guys who's just beginning to notice a trickling of some symptoms. Selenium was once considered the up-and-coming mineral star it's going to prevent prostate cancer. And then the SELECT trial, which was selenium and vitamin E in a prostate cancer prevention study, was closed. That the treatment group seemed to do worse than the control group, so that was closed. So that casts some doubt on whether selenium is good or not. Vitamin E used to be considered part of the prostate diet that you had to have vitamin E. Then a cardiology study, and the original recommendation was 800 international units of vitamin E daily. Then a cardiology study came out and said that in their group, 800 international units of vitamin E daily was associated with a higher death rate in that group than a group taking 400 international units of vitamin E. So people have backed down on vitamin E with the prostate. Zinc. Zinc, I unfortunately think, is overrated. There's one enzyme in the prostate that requires a zinc atom in the middle of it for this enzyme to work. So zinc has been touted as, aha, if you take zinc, then your prostate will be healthy. I don't think zinc supplementation really adds much to, and I think most patients just eating a well-balanced diet get more than enough of this really, really trace element zinc to supply their prostate and be healthy. So I don't think that you have to go out of your way and do zinc. Mm. There was a patient came to me once and said, what about milk with prostate cancer? I heard milk causes prostate cancer, and I heard milk doesn't cause prostate cancer. So we went to the library and pulled all studies on milk, and they are all over the place. In one country, drinking milk is associated with a higher risk for prostate cancer. In another country, drinking milk is associated with a less risk for prostate cancer. Suffice it to say that the data is scattered all over the place. One country's milk might be another, might not be another country's milk. One might be high in fat. One may be talking about skim milk, and there's a lot to tease out there. So we don't consider milk a right now. It's neutral as in terms of prostate cancer. Lycopene. Lycopene. The tomato growers are really pushing lycopene in terms of being a protective factor against some cancers, one of them prostate cancer. I don't see a downside in lycopene. The best way to take it is with some kind of a tomato concentrate, either soup or juice or sauce, something where the water's been boiled off. Gets you more concentrated lycopene. Three servings a week. I don't think that's impossible to reach. You know, a glass of tomato juice a day, boom, you've got your lycopene blast. It's interesting enough that everyone thinks that lycopene is the exclusive thing from tomatoes, but watermelon actually have more lycopene than tomatoes.
Really?
Yes.
Right.
So during the summer, eat that watermelon. Get your lycopene.
And generally, one of the things that they're for, in connection, I think, with a number of kinds of cancer, the issue of fat in the diet, how much there is and what kind of fat it is, has been raised as a concern. And generally speaking, the advice is, well, less fat, more fruits and vegetables, particularly less in the way of saturated fat. You know, that's a good way to go. Is it thought that there's any sort of anything that says that there's any kind of relationship between fat consumption and prostate cancer?
Absolutely, absolutely. Prostate cancer loves it grows best in a high fat diet environment. Studies were done at Memorial Sloan Kettering. They implanted prostate cancers on the backs of rats, and so they could measure the growth rates of the cancers over time. And they fed the rats different diets. And the fastest growth rate was high red meat, high fat diet. Mm-hmm. So a diet that's getting away from high fats, fried foods and fatty foods, getting more towards white meat, fish, chicken, pork, and vegetables, soy protein. Soy protein also seems to be a protective thing for prostate cancer.
All right. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest for the program is Dr. Ronald Conchanan. He's a urologist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And we've been talking here a lot about prostate issues, but other things that we're trying to carve out an area here that's specifically about men and concerns that men have with their health. It could be some different things, I'm sure. Whatever's on your mind, you can give us a call. And the doctor will do his best to see if he can answer your question. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I have another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on a different topic.
Sure.
I'm curious about the effects of blood pressure medication, if there are side effects, particularly side effects that have anything to do with erectile functioning.
These days, the blood pressure medicines that are used commonly are much, 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 much less have had that as a worry than in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 10 years ago, the medicines that we used, or 15 years ago, the medicines that we used for blood pressure had that as a side effect. But as a group, as a whole, that's less of a concern now. Erectile dysfunction is mainly a blood delivery issue to the penis. That seems to be the consensus opinion that it's just not getting enough blood to fill up the spongy tissue there and work. And that's not due to blood pressure, but usually due to small blood vessel disease. That these small blood vessels, the passage through them is restricted, and it just limits the blood flow.
So let me ask the question a little bit more specifically. I had at one point, well, my blood pressure is not high, but it's a little bit elevated, and so there's been some thinking, well, maybe I should take a mild dose of blood pressure medication.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hesitant because for a previous treatment, I had been prescribed I guess it's a diuretic that presumably that sometimes is prescribed also when one takes blood pressure medication.
Yes.
And I had that problem. I had an erectile problem when I took it, so I stopped and it went away, which made me very leery about moving to blood pressure medication. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I think primarily, control of blood pressure and having, you know, a good control of blood pressure or having a good control of blood sugar is going to do more for your health than bad. So if there are issues with blood pressure, I would say, yes, it's good to treat. Now, even though medicines are much better these days than in the past, I suppose there's still a tiny, tiny chance that one medicine might have some kind of a side effect. And I think then just mention it to your prescribing physician and say, hey, you know, that medicine is causing me this. Can we try something else? And sometimes even a different medicine in the same class might result in effective control of your blood pressure and less side effect.
So there's some variation among the possible medications that one would take to control blood pressure.
Is certainly.
Correct. I see. Okay. Well,
thanks very much. Thank you. Let's go to another caller here. Someone in here in Champaign County where we are, line 2. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I appreciate the program since I'm in an age when prostate is kind of a conundrum here. The European double-blind tests on natural herbs and things like that indicate that Pygium might be useful. Do you have any update on that?
Just in terms of my patients. Some use a mixture of saw palmetto and Pygium. I don't know that Pygium alone offers tremendous.
I'm on warfarin, so saw palmetto is out.
Well, I don't have any objection to trying Pygium and see what happens. In my experience, I have not had patients come back and say, boy, oh boy, you know, I tried saw palmetto, and when I went to saw palmetto and Pygium or Pygium alone, did that thing really improve my symptoms around?
So. Okay. The other question I have then is in regard to the false negatives in a PSA. You talked about the false positive, or rather... You talked about the over-identification and the need for biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
The biopsy then should give you information about false negatives. What's the percentage of false negatives in biopsy?
Well, a false negative is a guy who has a negative PSA and actually does have prostate cancer. Now, hopefully we'll pick some of those guys up by doing a rectal examination and saying, hey, you know what? That rectal exam doesn't feel right. There's a lump here, or it's asymmetric.
Yeah, so, I made the wrong connection there. That, indeed, it would be somebody who scored low on PSA and still had a cancerous condition.
In that case, for that gentleman, that's where serial PSA may come into play. Even if suppose his baseline PSA is 2 and the physician says, oh, your PSA is 2, that's nothing to worry about. Let's watch that guy's PSA. And if his PSA is rising greater than you normally feel comfortable with, then that would be a springboard to the biopsy. So PSA is not just I had it done once and that's it and I'm over and done with it. PSA is a dynamic thing. Like what's it doing over time?
So the advice is an annual PSA after a certain age. What if that appears to be steady? What's the chance that you still might have a cancerous condition?
Well, the chance, unfortunately, is not zero, but the chance is very low. The question is when are you going to find the prostate cancer? It would really not be effective to take everyone with a normal PSA and a normal rectal examination and say, well, there's a very, very small chance that you actually do have prostate cancer, so we're gonna biopsy you. That's a tough group to deal with. I'm sure that some of those people, a very small percentage, but will have prostate cancer that's going to escape detection at the earliest possible moment.
Last question then. If the indications are that you have some sort of cancer, I understand that there's slow growing and fast growing. Does the biopsy distinguish between the two?
Yes, because the biopsy can tell us there's something called the Gleason grading system, where you look at the most common element of prostate cancer and the second most common, and you match it up to Gleason's diagrams, and you get a score. And it ranges, the individual score ranges from 1 to 5. So the best you could be would be a 1+1, which we never see. That's a 2. And the worst you could be is 5+5 and 10. Most prostate cancers, the typical prostate cancer that presents is a Gleason 6. Above that, then you're dealing with high-grade tumor, which does have increased aggressiveness.
Thank you for your answers. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Dr. Ronald Peter Conchan. He's a urologist at Carl Clinic in Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I remember, I think, maybe the first time I ever talked with somebody, at least on this program, about erectile dysfunction was maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more, with one of your predecessors at Carl. And at the time, one of the big revelations or sort of one of the big changes in the way we thought about it was we previously had said, it's all in your head, and maybe you could see a therapist, but if I'm a urologist, there's not much I can do. And from there, we went to saying, well, actually, no, it's not in your head. It's a physical issue. And as you say, what it's about blood supply to the penis. And in fact, maybe the same things that concern us about heart disease and narrowing of blood vessels, it's kind of the same game, you know?
Exactly.
And so that, you know, was the big change that we said, no, it's a physiological deal. It's not, you know, we can do something about it. Now, at that time, though, the treatments were – there were some treatments, but some of them involved surgery and some of them involved, you know, doing unpleasant things. And then the next big thing was, well, we got a pill for you. So that makes it an easy thing. And now we have prescription medications that are for that. And you can go to your doctor and you can get that. I guess one of the things that I wonder about is what sort of – do we have enough track record on these – medications, things like Viagra and Levitra, these things, so that we know that there are no, you know, how much of it you can take and over what sort of a period you can take, and are there any possibility if we could have some serious long-term side effects as a result of taking these things?
Well, Viagra's been out since the mid-90s, so we're talking 15 years or so of experience, and patients are still doing well on it, and nothing is popping up that's a gigantic red flag. So the class of medicine seems to be well tolerated, and patients come back and still use it. So it's not like, okay, I used it for a month, it worked, now it's not working anymore. Mm-hmm. So there are three PDE5 inhibitors: Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis. And the difference between them is in the duration of how long the medicine sticks around in your body. Viagra and Levitra typically last for about 12 hours, whereas Cialis up to 36 hours. And that's the first line of treatment. It's interesting that as you were saying, it was all in your head. Then it became a physical thing, and then the rush was to do tests to find out. Oh, it's 9% this, and it's 14% this, but the answer is there's only a few ways to treat it. And since oral medications came out, it was like, okay, we have a patient with erectile dysfunction. Let's make sure that a few lab tests are basically normal: testosterone, thyroid studies, things like that. If those are okay, then try this medicine first and see if you respond. Then you tell the patient, okay, well, you responded, great, you stay on this. You didn't respond, here's what you can do. We can step the therapy up a little bit, combination therapy with perhaps a vacuum pump and medical therapy or what.
Well, of the percentage of guys who might come in with that as a complaint, who you would, generally assess their physical condition and say, well, okay, you're okay, and you would be a suitable candidate for one of these medications. Here, take this, try this, see what happens. What percentage of those patients then do respond and would come back and say, Doc, this is a great thing, I'm very happy, thank you very much, and we'll go on from there?
It's an upper 60-70% will respond to the oral medicine and be pretty happy with it. So I think that's certainly that speaks well for the oral medicines, that a significant proportion of men will respond to that.
All right. Well, we have some other callers. Let's go to Gridley, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, and I've been kind of in and out of the conversation. Forgive me if I reiterate something that was already spoken about. But wanted to know, I'm over 50, have had a very high PSA of like 11, and have had three biopsies now scheduled in 2 years, and we don't find anything. It feels fine. But we find precancerous cells or uncommon cells in these biopsies, very minute. Is there any, any timetable when we've waited and we're looking into what to do next, and thought maybe you had some ideas along that line?
Well, there are two issues. First of all, If we have a guy who's had a couple of biopsies and has a PSA that's considered really suspicious, like 11 would be considered high, you might want to consider having saturation biopsies performed. The standard set of prostate biopsies, about 12 cores of tissue are obtained by passing a needle into the prostate under ultrasound guidance. With saturation biopsies, I take 18 biopsies a side, so we're sampling closer, and we can sample a little bit deeper. Instead of putting the needle just at the edge of the prostate and sampling the most superficial tissue, we can pass the needle deeper into the prostate and get some cores. Now, that's not going to come up positive in every patient, but in my practice, about 50% of people that I've taken to the OR for saturation biopsies are found to have prostate cancer, whereas the office biopsies didn't. So if a guy's PSA is high or is rising with negative biopsies, I talk to the patient about that. That saturation biopsies we do in the operating room under sedation. It's just much more comfortable for the patient that way. The second issue that you mentioned is this precancerous thing, or I'm assuming PIN, which stands for prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, which a few years ago was thought to be a marker for the development of prostate cancer, or associated with the development of prostate cancer in perhaps up to 40% of men. That doesn't seem to be the case these days. Johns Hopkins, kind of did the work on high-grade prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, now don't see it as a risk factor and say that the finding of high-grade PIN on a biopsy is actually less important as just following the patient's PSA serially. So I would not be so worried that, okay, I found high-grade PIN on a previous biopsy, but my PSA is up, I don't have an answer. I would consider doing a bigger set of biopsies.
I see. Yeah, that's the next thing this summer that we're going to look at. But we're kind of interrupting the timing of this because we're thinking that maybe there's an infection or something that's causing this, and just do it at a different time of year might be a positive. So,
well, many physicians with a patient with negative biopsies, a PSA of 11, will say, "Hey, take a course of antibiotics, Septra or Cipro, something like that, for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and let's see if that makes the PSA go down." I think that's worth a try. In some patients, it's not universally successful, and in my practice, very, very few guys with a persistently elevated PSA that I put on antibiotics are going to have their PSAs go down. But it's worth a try.
Mm-hmm. But surgery is probably, when you're in that level, at some point you're going to be looking at that.
Well, the prostate biopsy in the OR is just it's like a regular set of prostate biopsies, except that we'll give you some intravenous sedation so that you just allow 18 biopsies a side to be taken.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
You're
we'll
welcome.
Try to get at least one more caller. The next in line is in Mattoon, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm about almost 80 years old. I've been on Terazosin for a couple of years, and then I went to Flomax, and Pernandahyde or whatever you call it. And I'm off the Flomax right now because none of us seem to help a whole lot. I was wondering if there was something out there that maybe would help more.
Well, we kind of have a stepwise therapy. You start with alpha blocker, the terazosin, add a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor such as finasteride or Avodart. And if that doesn't work and the patient is still symptomatic, then you're looking at minimally invasive therapy or a surgical therapy, a laser resection of the prostate, transurethral resection of the prostate. Minimally invasive therapy, microwave, which I don't think really stands up to the test of time. The TUNA procedure, again, I'm not sure whether that's a good long-term solution. But the next step then would be much more invasive procedure, laser or transurethral resection.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. One more caller here. Oh, well, that person changed their mind. We're just down to the point where we have maybe a minute or two left. Maybe I will. There was someone who asked this question off the air about something called yohimbine, which is apparently is sometimes used for erectile dysfunction. What do you know about that?
When I was a resident, we used yohimbine all over the place. Uh-huh. And because there really wasn't much else to use orally, and patients really didn't respond to yohimbine. I think yohimbine has fallen out of favor in terms of erectile dysfunction. There was a report last year that yohimbine might improve ejaculatory function. So if we had a patient who had ejaculatory difficulties, premature ejaculation, or a painful ejaculation, that yohimbine might have some use there. So that reason, so I don't think yohimbine is going away. It's not first line therapy.
All right. But it sounds like these other medications, the one that we're all familiar with that we see advertised so much, probably work a lot better.
A lot better.
A lot better. And then generally, you ask the question, well, what sort of things could someone do to maintain their sexual health and their ability to function sexually? It sounds as if, the prescription would be essentially the same kind of, if you say, well, I'd like to avoid heart disease and stroke. It would be the added benefit would be the other. It would be we'd say the same stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. Eat a smart, heart-healthy diet, and that's also good for your prostate and your urinary tract.
Yeah. And if guys feel like that they're having problems, urinary-related problems or problems with their sexual function, I'm sure that it's not, sometimes it's not the most comfortable thing to say, hold up your hand and say, hey, I've got this problem, but that they shouldn't hesitate to talk about these things with their doctors, because it sounds like for a range of these things, there are good treatment possibilities. So if you're having problems and if you're uncomfortable and it's not, making your life unhappy, you ought to do something about it.
Absolutely. There are treatments and your physicians are aware of them and trained to treat and talk to you about that. So,
all right. Well, there we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Ronald Peter Conchanan. He's a urologist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.